happened to just flip the TV on. I wanted to catch some of the news if there was something worthwhile. Many times there isn't. But they had a rerun of one of the movies, Strange Encounters of a Third Kind or something like that. If I remember, that movie is supposed to be a mystical experience for some people. And that's the topic that I'm going to be focusing on this evening. Mysticism, but from a Jewish perspective. When I've discussed this in various classes, I've asked people what they mean by mysticism. I think it's as important to find out what mysticism from a Jewish perspective is not as it is to find out what it is. Some of the definitions that people have told me about mysticism is that it's knowledge of the unknowable. You think about that for a minute. Knowledge of the unknowable. You're smiling, right? If it's unknowable, what kind of knowledge are we going to have of it? It's mysterious. Well, that's related to the same thing. Secret knowledge. It's secret knowledge that's been handed down from generation to generation. It's called Kabbalah. It's received. The Hebrew word Kabbalah means that which has been received, transmitted. The question is, why is it secret and what kind of secret it is, or is it? Just to deal a little bit with that first, some people think that it's secret because there's all kinds of mysterious powers and forces that you can tap into, and if you know these secrets, then you can control things or people and so on. The fact is, knowledge gives you power. But is knowledge mysterious? Only to those of us who don't understand the particular knowledge. If I go to an Aborigine and I go like this and fire comes from my finger, he thinks that's magic and I've got power over him because I know something that he doesn't know. Except all of you know, just imagine I'm holding a Bic lighter in my hand and now you know exactly how and why the fire can flame from my thumb. There are forces. There are many, many forces in this world. They've all been created by God. And if you have knowledge of those forces, you do have power. But unfortunately, for some people, they're not that mysterious. The laws of science are very mysterious if you don't understand them. And as the prophet says, "Mibesari echeze Hashem," from my flesh I can see God. If we study the wonders of the nature of the body, if we try to understand just how the skin works, how a nail grows, how a cell operates, how can a woman, we're talking this morning about Sarah and Hagar, a woman getting pregnant, you know how many, I don't even know, but there's a myriad of things that have to go right in order for a pregnancy to occur, then to keep the pregnancy, to nurse the fetus, and to have, God willing, a healthy child. All of those are the miracles of the forces of God's creation. Wonderful power. Maimonides mentions in his Guide to the Perplexed that there are some people who would prefer to interpret a statement in the Talmud that says something to the effect that within the womb of a woman, there's an energy that a fire that can burn from one end of the universe to the other end of the universe. And people would like to take that literally. But if you think about it, how is it possible for a woman to have that kind of a hot stuff in her womb and survive? In fact, what he says, it's just saying something about the potential of what is within the womb of a woman when she's pregnant. She has a child, it's the beginning of life, the creation of the human being. That human being which is in the woman's womb has the capability of changing the universe. That's even more powerful than any kind of fire, in fact. But it's a metaphor. It's a metaphor. So, I don't believe it's related to this kind of mystical power. It's not mysterious. Oh, it's secret. Well, the Hebrew word for secret is sod. Sod. There's also the term that is used as sod, related to, in rabbinic literature, sod ha'ibur. The secret related to the operation of the lunar cycle. Essentially, we're dealing with an area called, in English, astronomy. In Hebrew, it's called Sod HaIbur. And the reason it's called a soda secret is because it requires a great deal of training, mathematical training, knowledge of astronomy that most people don't go through, knowledge of physics and various other sciences, in order to fully comprehend and understand exactly how the lunar cycle operates, so that then you can deal with that in the area of Jewish law. So it's a sod, not because there's anything mysterious about it, not because it's not available to anybody who wants to study it, but it's only a sod, a secret, because most people don't know about it, so it's unknown. So I think a lot of these sodos, secrets in Kabbalah, are only secrets because we don't know about them. But there are certain things that we're not supposed to know about with regards to Kabbalah, and I'll get to that a little bit later as well. The one point I'd like to emphasize is that the essential pivotal issue of mysticism is related to God. It's related to relating to God. The question that every mystic, and I'm using the term generically now, Jewish and non-Jewish, every mystic wants to have a relationship with God. And the question is, how do I, that could be any I, how do I relate to God? What am I supposed to do? Now, what's the problem with relating to God? Well, if God is non-physical, if God transcends this universe, if God is such that he is not within our realm of experience, I'm automatically set up in some kind of a problem, and that's the Jewish problem. God is non-Jewish. I mean, wrong term. He's not Jewish. He's neutral. But he's not physical. He's not anything that we can define. God is not anything that we can establish within our experience as physical beings. So then, within the Jewish frame of reference, how do I relate to God? That's the problem that the Jewish mystics have to deal with as well. And there is a Jewish answer. I'm pretty sure that Rabbi Chait must have touched upon how to relate to God in his talk. I kibitzed with him before. I think he's the real mystic. He's the real Baal Kabbalah there, even though he's a, quote, rationalist. But it is an interesting phenomenon in the research that I've done around Kabbalah. And one of the reasons I got involved in it, let me share that with you. One of the reasons I really got involved in this area was there were people in my congregation, in my community, who were getting involved in various missionary activities. Some of them were Christian, and so I had to analyze some things vis-a-vis Christianity. Some of them were getting involved in various other cults. Down the street from my synagogue, there was a meeting hall that some people were renting above a hardware store for the group of the Maharaji Ji, if you remember him. I don't know what happened to him lately, but he's since disappeared off the scene. But I had a project that I had to be doing, and I was in the hardware store, and I asked the storekeeper, you know, what's with this group upstairs? What are their principles? What do they do? How do they operate? And he says, well, the fellow standing next to you, he's from the group. Maybe he can answer your questions. We got into a little conversation. The conversation went something to the following effect. The Maharaji Ji is like every other religious leader, every other prophet, Muhammad, Jesus, Moses, everybody includes Moses in all of this as well. And they all try to compare themselves to Moses. Just like all of them, they all went up on top of a mountain, spoke to God, and got this information. So the Maharaji Ji, that's what he did also. He sits down, does his meditation, and he has an experience, and he starts poking me in the chest, and God is right here in your heart too. And if you would sit and meditate, you too would experience God. I said, no, I wouldn't. And the reason I wouldn't is because I know a little something about psychology. I also do therapy. And I know how the human mind works. I know how the emotions work. And I said to him, no, that won't work. What do you guys do? You sit in a hot room, you know, if you've raised the temperature, and you sit down and stick your tongue up against the roof of your mouth, close your eyes and sit like that for a half an hour, something is going to happen. Guaranteed. I didn't say what, but it doesn't matter what. Whatever it is, they say, that's God. But that's a physical experience. It may be an emotional experience. It may even be an intellectual experience. But I don't believe that's God. But it got me to thinking. Got me to thinking because now we have a problem with prophecy. And the issue was raised this afternoon in some of our discussion as well. What is prophecy? How do I know that prophecy is accurate? Now, what relationship does prophecy have to this mysticism? Within Jewish tradition, within the Torah tradition, the Navi, the prophet, is the one who has the highest relationship with God. After all, what happens to the Navi? Whatever he does, and that's part of the oral tradition, some of the procedures that the Nevi'im follow, that the prophets follow, may have been lost. They probably have been. Maybe there are people who have access to that tradition. I'm not ready to judge that. But the Navi has what element in common with the mystic? He has a communication from God. And that's what the mystic is trying to do. He's trying to get a communication from God. Now, I'm the outsider. I take a look at Chaim Shmerl, who says he's a prophet. Now, how do I know that he's a prophet? How can I confirm that he, in fact, is having a mystical experience? Better yet, let's say I want to do it. I want to have this relationship with God. And I want to fulfill what we say in the Shema, the Ohavtois Hashem Elokecha, shall love the Lord your God. So I'm going to sit and try to get this mystical experience. Now, how do I know what's happening inside of me? How do I know that? Are there guidelines? I believe there are guidelines. The guidelines are found in the oral Torah, in the oral tradition. The guidelines are found in the literature of Kabbalah, which is part of the oral tradition. Now, what I'd like to do is kind of clarify a little bit of some of the oral tradition for you and then come back to the issue of prophecy. And I think it's important because even if you look at the biblical text and quote verses, ultimately you need to rely on an oral tradition. I know David touched on that. There's a Talmudic story that I think illustrates this beautifully. It's found in the tractate Sabbath. And it's a story about Hillel and his associate also Shammai, but I only want to focus on the Hillel part of the story for these purposes. There was a prospective convert who sincerely wanted to convert and become Jewish. And he came to Hillel and he said, teach me and I'll convert. There's two or three other stories on the same page. In this story, Rabbi Hillel said, all right, fine. If you want to become a Jew, you've got to accept the written Torah and the oral Torah. And the prospective convert scratched his head and he said, oh, wait a minute, Rabbi Hillel. The written Torah, I got that in a book. I'll accept that. The oral Torah, I've got problems with that. I don't want to deal with that. So Rabbi Hillel, being a patient teacher, said, okay, good enough. Let's get to work then on the written Torah. So first thing you have to do, you have to learn the alphabet. So he started teaching the Aleph Beis. And being a diligent student, he went home, memorized his letters, and he came back the next day ready to go on with his lessons. And Rabbi Hillel totally blew his mind away because when he was ready to show off his studies, Rabbi Hillel said, well, what letter is this? Oh, that's an Aleph. No, that's a Beis. Now, wait a minute. Yes, what's this next letter? That's an Aleph. And the next one, whatever he said, Rabbi Hillel said the opposite. He changed everything around on him. At this point, he was totally exasperated. He says, Rabbi Hillel, what are you doing to me? What is it that you're doing? Yesterday, the Aleph was an Aleph. Today, it's a Beis. The Beis is an Aleph. The Gimel is a... Every letter is totally different than it was yesterday. And Rabbi Hillel's response to him was, just as you have to rely upon me for the written text, so too rely upon me for the oral text. Contained within that story is the basic idea as well. How do you know what the alphabet is? How do you know how to read a letter except for the fact of an oral tradition? The fact is, and again David touched on that, there is nothing in our experience that really does not rely on an oral tradition. You know, when I do this in a class, is there anyone here who's an electrician? Just out of curiosity. Is there? Oh, there is. That's a good one, because that's nice physical labor, or even a carpenter. Do you work here in this area, or do you work somewhere else? Doesn't matter, but the likelihood is you've got a code book of all kinds of laws, all kinds of requirements, plus you have books that you had in school when you learned electrical work or when you learned carpentry. Now, can I take those books and just read them and figure out how to do the wiring? Or maybe I could read the books and figure out how to fix your PA system for you, David. Do you think I could do that? By just reading the books. Can't do it. Why not? Can you learn how to do brain surgery by reading the medical text? I sure hope you don't. The answer is you need to work with a teacher who's going to be telling you things orally, oral tradition. You name the field, you name the body of study, there's always an oral tradition there. Within the Torah system, right from the beginning at Mount Sinai, the oral tradition was established, and it was codified, and it was deliberately put into place. Moses, of course, was the first individual who set it up. But if you take a look in Deuteronomy, chapter 17, verse 8, if there arise a matter too hard for you in judgment, between blood and blood, between plea and plea, between stroke and stroke, even matters of controversy within your gates, then you shall arise and get thee up unto the place which the Lord thy God shall choose, which is the place where the law comes from, which is from the Sanhedrin. And you shall come unto the priests, the Levites, and unto the judge that will be in those days, and thou shalt inquire, and they shall declare unto thee the sentence of thy judgment. And thou shalt do according... Well, the Hebrew is a little different. You shall be asiso al pi hadovar. Pi refers to the mouth. You shall go in accordance with the verbalization of the word, the davar, asher yagidu lecha, that they will declare, that they will tell to you. Yagidu lecha is the same root word for haggadah. The retelling of the Passover Seder is called Haggadah, that which is spoken. So right from the Torah we see that the law and its Yorucha, that which they shall teach you, which is the same root as in verse 11, Alpi HaTorah Asher Yorucha, in accordance with the Torah which they will teach you. Torah is teaching according to the teaching which they will in fact teach to you. So right from the beginning we see there is an oral tradition. You can go to any of the commandments, any of the observances, they're all related to an oral tradition. Now, what is contained in this oral tradition? Now, I have this chart here for you. It's the one that starts with the Sinai revelation up at the top. Now, right after the revelation, you have Moses, who's had his experience at Sinai. And the fact is, Moses himself didn't have the experience. This is where it's different than the mystical experiences of every other group. There were, at least on my calculation, a conservative calculation, there were 3 million plus people at Mount Sinai. 600,000 Hebrew men, heads of household. If you want to figure 5 family members per household, which is a very conservative estimate, you know, 2 husband and wife, 3 children, that's 5. 5 times 600,000, that gives you 3 million. Very conservative estimate. You have 3 million people at Mount Sinai, and all 3 million people had the same experience. What was their experience? The experience that they had was that they all perceived this revelation, this communication from God. And the revelation at Sinai's purpose was for that. If you take a look in Exodus chapter 19, verse 9, God says to Moses, Behold, Hine Anochi Boelecha, behold, I come to you in the thick cloud, in order that the Hebrew word means the large body of people, the whole large group, the whole nation, shall hear Yishma Bedabri Imach, when I, God, speaking, when God will speak with you. And then V'gam B'chor Yaminu, and then they will also believe in you. So then that really deals with the issue. Moses has a private experience of having God speak to him. Now, remember I mentioned Chaim Shmerl before. If he claims that he's a prophet, how do I know that what he's experiencing is prophecy? How do I know what message he's experienced? How can I accept any prophet? Well, first thing is I have to accept Moses as a prophet. How do I know that the institution of prophecy will even work through Moses and his experience and the fact that at least 3 million plus people had the same experience? And not only that, not only did they have the same experience, but they were confident enough, to continue and make sure that the rest of the experience would be handled by Moses and God. In Deuteronomy chapter 5, verses 21 and so on. In verse 21, God, the people say, Behold, the Lord our God has shown us His glory and His greatness, and we have heard His voice out of the midst of the fire. We have seen this day that God does speak with man, and they all experienced it. This wasn't just something that Moses experienced on the top of the mountain by himself, because the initial experience, he was down with everybody else. He went up back onto the mountain afterwards, and it was at the consensus of God, Moses, and the people of Israel that Moses then became the go-between. If you continue reading the text, you'll find that there. God consented to the plan of the people of Israel that now Moses would be the go-between. So now we're set up with the following scenario. God, the Almighty, has accepted this plan, and He's chosen Moses to be the one to present the information. Now, do you think that God will pick someone who isn't capable of presenting the information correctly and accurately? I think not. I think God knows what He's doing and knows whom He's selecting, and that Moses would therefore present the information accurately. And so we have confirmed the idea of Moses the prophet. Well, now after that, now I have to deal with other prophets, right? How do I know that there is such a thing as prophecy? How do I know that somebody else can have this kind of a mystical relationship with God and receive communication from God? Only through the fact that Moses tells us that it's possible. Without Moses, without the confirmation of Moses as a prophet, I have no idea that I can accept any other prophet. And I have no methodology, I have no way of dealing with it either. And that's chapter 18, verses 15, 16 through 18. God says that a prophet will the Lord thy God raise up unto thee from the midst of thee of thy brethren, like unto me, or Moses is saying rather, unto him you shall listen, according to all that you did desire of the Lord your God in Horeb, in the day of the assembly, saying, let me not hear again the voice of the Lord my God. So Moses is reaffirming the fact that he was appointed by consensus, neither let me see this great fire anymore, and I die not. And the Lord said unto me, they have said well that which they have spoken. So God agreed with the basic idea of the people. And in verse 18, I will raise them up a prophet from among their brethren, like unto thee, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak unto them that all that I shall command. So Moses tells us that we're to listen to a prophet. If Moses doesn't tell us to listen to a prophet, why should I listen to a prophet? And then it shall come to pass Whoever will not listen to those words, right, I will seek it out from him. But then that prophet in verse 20, who will speak in God's name, asher lo tziviv ledaber, something that I did not command. Umes hanavi yahu, that prophet will be liable to the death penalty. He shall die. And then if we're going to say in our hearts, how shall we know the word which the Lord has not spoken? When a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, all right, if it happens, all right, what's my translation? If the thing follow not, if something doesn't happen, if the prophet makes a prediction and it doesn't come true, then it's not true. Then it's false. So it seems like there's two issues here. If the prophet says something that God didn't command, and also if the prophet makes predictions that don't come true. What happens, though, if a prophet comes along and says, well, Moses said the truth, and what he said at one time was true, but now it's no longer true? What is the basis for listening to that prophet? I think that that prophet now has boxed himself in. Because if I maintain that I'm a prophet, the only way I can validate my position is through Moses. And if I negate some of the teachings of Moses, then I'm no longer a prophet. So either I accept Moses, or I reject prophecy totally, or else I reduce prophecy into the very things that are described in the Torah in the whole beginning of the chapter before, starting with verse 9. It's witchcraft. It's magic. Now, if we look at the body of oral Torah is very important in terms of establishing the credentials of the prophet as well, because it's the Sanhedrin at the temple who would be charged with establishing and confirming that someone was a Navi, that someone was a prophet. But I'd like to focus not on that, but perhaps a little bit on some of the qualifications and qualities that a prophet would have to have, because that would be the quality of Moses. Moses was an individual who had the best education that was humanly possible in the ancient world. And where was he educated? In the household of Pharaoh. He was adopted by the Pharaoh, so he had the best university education at that time. One of the principles of prophecy is that God does not give human beings prophetic information except and unless it's something that they can't derive with their own human devices. So the laws of medicine, the laws of physics, they're not in the Bible. They're not in the Torah, because we can figure that out by ourselves. But how to develop the soul, how God operates in the world, what we're supposed to do in terms of ethics and morality, that we need some assistance with. That's what we're taught in the Torah in combination with the oral Torah. The development of the Navi, there really is a book that's in the Talmud that many people don't know about, many Jews don't know about either, that is a prophecy training guide, but we don't even look at it that way. Pirkei Avos, Ethics of the Fathers. It's found in all of the prayer books usually, and the rabbis in the Talmud say that that book raises a person to be the level of a chassid, a pious individual. It means that their soul has reached a certain level of development, and according to the way Maimonides sets it up, the person is following a golden mean, middle of the road in a sense. But that's a metaphor for something. It's a metaphor for how we're supposed to serve God, and I believe it relates also to the Shema, which you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, with all your might. And in the Hebrew, it says, Levavacha. David, can you help me out with chapter and verses on that now? Okay. For people to reference it. But Levavacha, the Hebrew word, it could be, you shall love the Lord your God with your libecha, with your heart. The Hebrew says, Levavacha. And the rabbis point out that there's two letters, the letter Beis refers as the number two, to Shnei Yitzrucha, to your two inclinations, your two emotional proclivities. The Yetzer Hara, the Yetzer Tov, the good inclination and the evil inclination. Now, how do I serve God with my evil inclination? Well, I'll just tell you basically what they are. The evil inclination is the desire to satisfy the various appetites. It's the basic emotional, the base emotions of the human being. And I use the word base deliberately, because base, it's the foundation upon which everything is built. It's the sexual drive, it's the drive towards eating, towards food, the sensual drive, the drive towards satisfying the senses. That's the Yetzer Hara. Then you have the good inclination, that's the bad inclination. Why is it bad? Not because there's anything inherently evil about any of the components of the human being. It's just that human beings tend to overemphasize and overindulge and overinvolve themselves in these areas, and so it tends to be bad for them, for us. On the other hand, the Yetzer Tov, the good inclination, are the good emotions, the desire for approval, the desire to do good things, the desire to have people look at me and think, wow, what kind of a wonderful person are you? Those are some examples of the Yetzer Tov, the good inclination. Now, how can I serve God with any of these emotions? If I do, then I'm going to really run into problems. The answer is that I have to use the stuff up here to control the stuff down here. If I use my mind to understand how they work and how they operate, then I can serve God with all of my components, with my emotions, the good emotions, the not yet so good emotions, all of the emotions. But if I let the emotions operate all by themselves, I'm going to do the wrong thing. An example, if I want approval and I'm with my friends and my friends are going to be doing something wrong, should I do what they say in order to get the approval? Or should I exercise my ability to think and judge and say, wait a minute, I do want approval, but not approval for doing the wrong thing. And I don't want everybody's approval all the time, but I can use the issue of approval in a positive way by following the Torah. If I realize that I enjoy getting people's approval, so then I can get people's approval by doing the good, by following the Torah system. It's a wonderful feeling to give a nice lecture and people come up to you and say, I really enjoyed that. Well, that's a positive way of getting approval. Maimonides also indicates that the base emotions, if you will, the base drives, can also be used to serve God. If I eat healthy food in order to maintain my body, if I have love relationships in order to put my emotions in order, if I go to sleep in order that I can get up tomorrow and study Torah, well, now I'm using all of the appetites and the base elements of my being as a means of serving God. So that's how we serve God with those base elements, but I have to use the mind. The Ohavto Es Hashem, love the Lord your God. It's through knowledge. I know Rabbi Chaik gave a whole lecture on that. Knowledge. Knowledge of God. Knowledge of God enables me to relate to God. But now I'm back to the original problem that we started with. How do I relate to God if He's not of this universe, if He transcends it and He created it? The answer is indirectly. Indirectly, by a knowledge of that which God created. If I study myself, if I study the creations of God, which includes the Torah as well, then I can get an indirect method of understanding how God operates in the world. And that's the way of the mystic. That's the way of the Jewish Baal Kabbalah. Every Baal Kabbalah that I'm aware of, the legitimate ones, they study the Torah as a methodology of reaching a relationship with God. They're involved in this oral Torah. This oral Torah has tons of material to it. And before they can get into what's called the real Kabbalistic literature, and when most people think of Kabbalah, they think of Zohar, right? They think of Zohar. But before anyone can get into the Kabbalah literature, they have to master all of the other elements of the Jewish literature. And that's what's on this chart. The written Torah, the oral Torah. If you look at the written Torah, it contains the five Mosaic books, plus the writings of the prophets on my chart. And then you have the various commentaries, which of course come from the oral Torah. But if we go to the oral Torah, there's two basic bodies of literature that are contained within oral Torah. You have Midrash and Mishnah. Now, I also have a third arrow there, assorted extra legal material. That really should be subordinated to Mishnah, because it's very similar to Mishnah. Now, the Mishnah was put together by Rabbi Judah the Prince as a basic summary of the information in the oral Torah as to what to do and how to observe the commandments. And the information in the Mishnah was organized by subject material. And I'm going to try to breeze through this. The Talmud Bavli, the Talmud Yerushalmi, elaborate the principles that have been set up in the Mishnah. And we have assorted commentaries, and I list a number of them for you. This information is taken by various rabbis and developed into various halacha collections, Jewish law as to what to do and how to go about doing things on a practical day-to-day basis. And then if you look all the way at the bottom, the assorted codes that are in operation today, Maimonides' code, which is called Yad HaChazakah, the Arba Turim, and the Shulchan Aruch, which are the foundation of the code of Jewish law, that's what's used today with various commentaries. That's the what of the oral tradition. How do I observe the various commandments? Rabbi Chait mentioned earlier today that there are two simultaneous or two concurrent frames of reference that are operating simultaneously. The area of Jewish law and then the area of Jewish philosophy. Well, most of the philosophical material is not contained in the Jewish law per se, because all Jewish law is concerned about what do I do, how do I observe the commandment. But contained within the Talmud, there is non-legal material that follows sort of the sequence of the law as well in subject area, but it deals with issues of metaphysics, it deals with issues of philosophy, it deals with issues of psychology. This material, though, most people don't know, is also contained in the Midrash. The Midrash, the way I would categorize it, in fact, the Midrash and Talmud, I think, contain the exact same information. There's no difference in the information in the Midrash in terms of content. The only difference that there is how the information is sequenced. That's one. And then there's another thing with it. The Mishnah was put together by Rabbi Judah the Prince because with the destruction of the temple and the beginnings of the breakdown of the Roman Empire, Rabbi Judah realized the Jews are not going to have a centralized authority. They're going to need to know how to observe Judaism. The Sanhedrin was not there anymore. We needed a centralized authority, so we put it into a book. Even though it was prohibited to put the oral Torah into writing, it was a necessary condescension to the historic situation. It would have been lost altogether. So by putting it into this book and having it accepted universally by the observant Jewish community, now we had a place to go to know what to do. The Midrashic information, though, was put together and put into writing at many different times. However, it was not put together for the purposes of establishing what to do within Jewish law. It was put down simply to explain textual questions and issues as they came up. And if you notice, there's a whole collection of different things that have been put into writing today. One of them is the Zohar. The Zohar, which is considered to be the main body of information for Kabbalah, in fact, operates exactly the same way as all the other Midrashim, and in fact, operates the same way as the Talmud does. What is necessary, though, What is necessary in all of these is to have a knowledge of how the oral Torah operates. And I know in 6 minutes or 7 minutes I'm not going to be able to do that. That's not what I intended to do. Rabbi Chait has been doing that very, very well with you, showing you how the oral law operates, how the oral Torah operates, and probably many times how Midrashim operate as well. So I think you've seen with Rabbi Chait's teaching that there is a methodology and there is a way of thinking and approaching and analyzing these various components of the oral Torah. Now the Midrash has the same information as does the Talmud, but the Talmud puts the information, and Talmud is Mishnah and Bavli and all that together. The Talmud sequences the information by subject area. Many of the Midrashim, if you will look at them, are sequenced according to the order of the text of the Bible, of the Torah. There's one famous one called the Yalkut, and I call him the first database. What the author or the editor of the Yalkut did is anytime he read some rabbi's writing, a speech or something, and he saw that they analyzed the text of the Bible, he pulled it out and put it in the sequence according to the biblical text. So if you take the Yalkut, the collection of the Midrash of the Yalkut, you have a running commentary de facto of the whole text of the Bible. But it was done as a convenience. It's done as a convenience, as a means of maintaining the information. But it does not go by subject matter, except as it follows the biblical text. Now, that being the case, what I'm essentially saying is the information that's found in Kabbalah is no different than the information that's found in the Talmud. The problem that occurs is that people look at it and don't know what it is that they're looking at. Same issue that occurs when people look at the Talmud. They read it and don't know what it is. What happens in the Talmud, and take a look at this other chart, and it'll make it easier to go through the synergism of Torah chart. If you ignore the first two columns and just look at the last two columns where it says halacha and agada, the word agadata is similar again to the Hebrew word haggadah. There's two components in the Talmud, the halachic material and the non-halachic material, which is called agadata. And we study both of these, but the study of Jewish law, of halacha, is a study of various cases. Each case is a paradigm. You study the case, you develop a principle from that, and now what happens is you learn how to think. Right, one of the classic, an ox goring another ox. That's a standard case in the Talmud. Now what does that have to do with 20th century America? Seemingly nothing. I mean, our friend Dr. Shum was talking about modernizing the law so that it can apply to the modern world. Well, one of the cases that are mentioned in the Talmud of a type of damage, if an ox is walking along and kicks up a pebble, and that pebble breaks one of the jugs of one of the people in the marketplace. Well, I've had that happen to me. Not in the marketplace, but once I was driving along in a country road in upstate New York, and there was this truck in front of me, and all of a sudden, you know, it was like everything went in slow motion. I see this huge, not a pebble, but a huge rock come flying out from under the tire of this truck, and it comes shooting at my windshield. Well, believe it or not, this case from the Talmud went through my mind as I saw it happening as well. But fortunately, the windshield didn't break. It just left a little chip. All right. So we have these cases in the Talmud that really, in fact, can be applied to the day as well. You talk about an ox goring with its horn. Well, the kind of damage that an animal does with its horn is aggressive damage. So that's an illustration of an animal acting in an aggressive manner. But then why did the rabbis present the Talmudic principles in these kinds of metaphors, even in Jewish law? My hypothesis is that they were concerned for a couple of things. Number one, the net result of putting the cases this way means that I can transmit this information 20 centuries ago and in the 20th century, and it's the same case. it won't get distorted, because an ox is an ox is an ox, whether I'm living in Pittsburgh in an urban area or if I'm living in the country. If I'm living in Israel on a farm, it's still an ox. And if I don't know what the ox looks like, I can go to my Encyclopedia Britannica, or today you can look on a CD-ROM, and see a picture of what the ox is and find out what a horn is. And it doesn't matter what culture or society I'm in. It's transmitted accurately. The next thing is, since I have the case, I have to analyze it and develop the idea and the underlying principle. Then the next step is, though, I have to make a practical decision as to what to do and how to go about doing it. And I need to do it. So there I develop my codes. Now, what has happened in Jewish law, the codes have become authoritative, because I need to know practically, when is the Sabbath? What am I supposed to do for the Sabbath? How am I supposed to keep kosher? What am I supposed to do to slaughter an animal? So I have to make practical decisions, even though I may have a variance of opinions within the Talmud. In the other material, the non-halachic material, which is in the second column, we don't make decisions. We can't necessarily make decisions in those areas formally for everybody. However, I believe that the people who are involved in Kabbalah have studied this material. They've studied this material, and they have made decisions, and they've written some books, and those are some of these other books that deal with Kabbalah. But here's the problem that I think occurs, and I think I'm running out of time. David, how much time do I have? Oh, boy. All right. The issue is like this. The Baal HaKabbalah, the person who's involved in this study, he's looking at all of his non-legal material, and he's trying to derive a system related to philosophy, psychology, and metaphysics that's contained in all of this information. And the person is going to be making practical decisions. The person who's a Navi, he has to make decisions about developing his soul. He has to work out some ideas about God. He has to know what's going on internally within him to understand how his mind works. Because the only one who's going to be able to determine, is this a prophecy or is it not a prophecy, is the person himself. And so therefore, he's going to study this material to gain knowledge, to be able to apply it to himself. Now, historically, what would happen is that the person who's doing the study is going to make use of the best available scientific information of his or her age, regardless of where it comes from. And so if you look in the medieval period, you have people who are working and becoming developed within the area of Kabbalah, and they're using phrenology, the study of the bumps on the head. They're using palmistry, palm reading. Why are they doing that? They're using that because that was the best available psychology that people used at that time. And so they incorporated these techniques within their decision-making process of the Agadata. And what happens today is people look at that information and they figure, aha, palm reading, that's Kabbalah. Phrenology, yeah, that's Kabbalah. But they're looking at the wrong thing. Today, in order to be a good Baal Kabbalah, what you have to do is know Freud, cognitive therapy, NLP, it's neuro-linguistic program, it's a kind of hypnosis. That's what you would need to know today. And if you don't know the human psyche, then you can't determine what's going on inside of you with the mystical experience. I guess I need to summarize. I'd say that the prophecy of Moses establishes the first group mystical experience of relating to God. And it's not that mysterious from our perspective. It's more mysterious because we truly do not understand God. But we can relate to that which God has created. God has created a Torah. He's given us an oral and a written Torah. And if we study that, if we understand that, that will teach us something about how God operates, and indirectly we may gain some understanding of how God operates. In order to do that as well, we need to develop our soul. We need to develop ourselves. And I didn't get a chance to get into it with this chart, but this chart really shows how that works too. Maybe I can say it in 30 seconds. If you study Jewish law, Torah, what the next thing you're going to try to do is implement the teachings of Torah. If you're going to implement teachings of Torah, that means you're going to behave in a certain way. And I think you've all learned by now that that means your mind is going to control everything else. When you start eating in accordance with Torah law, you start asking questions, is this food permissible or is this food not permissible? For me, as an Israelite and following halacha, so tonight I can go back, open the refrigerator and see what's available to eat. So the first thing I'm going to have to ask myself is, did I eat meat or milk before? If I ate meat, I'm going to have to wait. So I can't just go ahead and engage in the normal appetite, but I have to start thinking about the law of God. All right? Now, as I learn more of the law, then I get a greater appreciation of God's wisdom within the law, which stimulates me to go back to God's Torah, which stimulates me to go back to perform the mitzvos again, but I've now changed. I'm a different person. My soul has now changed. On the other side, emotionally, by emphasizing the intellectual component and controlling, not removing, but only controlling the emotional component, I rationalize, in a sense, and I'm using that term a little differently than the psychological defense mechanism, but I'm translating the emotions into a rational frame of reference. Again, I've changed my soul. If I keep doing this, it's a continuous feedback loop. The Baalei HaKabbalah are also doing this with Agadata, with the non-legal material. The rabbis, in fact, are doing it with the non-legal material as well. Because if I study the parables that teach me ideas, I have to wrestle with them. As I wrestle with them, that means I try to interpret them. That means I exercise energy on it. And when I exercise the right thought process, then I understand it. Instead of the idea just being handed to me, I have to work it through and understand it. That shifts my soul again. Greater appreciation of Torah. I'm a different person. I'm doing the mitzvah differently again. And that is my understanding of the development of the soul. It's necessary to do that to become a Navi, to become a prophet. And it's necessary to do the exact same thing to have, quote, a mystical relationship with God that's based on Torah. So that means that all of us here can do it, and there's only one simple basic methodology. The only thing is it takes us a lifetime to acquire. And what's that methodology? Study of Torah. Thank you.